This is the second session with Mr. Fred Miller being conducted at his office at the Portland General Corporation. The date is November 24th, 1993. All right, Fred, I wanted to start with a little recap, as I said in my notes, of some of the things from our first session. The first tape did turn out very well, and so there are just a few things that I have. One is we discussed very, very briefly about your own family's political views. We never quite established what they were. How would you describe your parents politically?
Can you play it back and see?
Right. Are
you
no, gonna, it was okay. Just yours. Okay, right.
I can't remember lots of discussions of the variety of sitting around the dinner table talking politics. That really didn't happen. And with my dad in particular, you sometimes had to infer views because he wasn't real outspoken. I would say, however, that I would infer just from the time I became politically conscious that he leaned towards being a Democrat, and I wouldn't have been able to categorize my mother early, but as it turns out, they both tended to vote Democrat.
So can you remember their views of FDR?
No, that just preceded my thoughts, and I can't remember during World War II. I was born in 1942, so I wasn't real politically active then. I don't think I could say how they felt about a Korean War. I do remember favoring Stevenson over Eisenhower. So at that time, that's about the first recollection I've got of any views. And I think they were surprised that Johnson did as well as he did. I probably disliked Johnson some, and it related to Vietnam views more than they did. And I remember my dad arguing that, well, he was doing pretty well domestically.
So he liked the idea of a more active role of government in the personal lives of people?
I'm inferring that because I've never heard him state that. And while he was in business, you might think that he'd take a more business-like view than that. But it seems to me the personal values were that the government did have a role to play there of the Johnson variety.
One of the recurring themes of your earlier tape was your growing skepticism about government and some of the actions of our government in your formative years. Did your parents share that type of view?
I'm sure they did, just because the thing that bothered me related lots to what I saw as an integrity issue, and that was very important to my dad. So I think he had to have a similar reaction.
But it wasn't a major focus of discussion in your family, political views?
No, we didn't really have major discussions.
Right. Now, one of the things that intrigues me is that for a person that did have skepticism about government, you entered into government at a fairly young age. Can you address some of your thinking at that point in time, why you decided to go into government?
I don't think that my movement was that conscious, for one, but if there was a skepticism, it was really more on the national level and national policy. And I didn't relate, for example, teaching at Oregon State University. I didn't think that of that as a government job, although really it is. And when I had a chance to go to the State Department of Transportation on a consulting contract. That didn't strike me as government. And even when I signed on, the issues were not those of major national policy and integrity. It was really a matter of how do you get a job done with a narrower focus.
So you saw a major distinction between state government and federal
government. I really wasn't thinking in terms of government. I thought in terms of here's an interesting job, something that I could contribute. And I could still, at the same time, have about the same beliefs of what was going on nationally.
And you saw your contribution at that time being what?
I don't think I was thinking in such a high-minded way. At first, I went as a consulting on the consulting contract to talk about how economics related to a highway division. Well, that's maybe an interesting economic assignment, and maybe it contributes something to a Department of Transportation or a highway division, but it's not on the same level as contribution to society, in my view. And in the next job I took, it was more focused on doing policy work or economic work for the highway division or Department of Transportation.
Another recurrent theme of the first session was your interest in Latin America,
mm-hmm.
and seems to have been a very long-standing interest that you had. Can you remember any of the early introductions you had to Latin America from teachers or?
I really didn't develop that interest in Latin America until I went to Michigan State University, and it happened really because I was doing my doctoral dissertation and needed a topic, and it followed the trip I took to Europe the year I graduated from college, and I had some exposure to other cultures and other countries that I really liked. So when I went to Michigan State, I started focusing on economic development, and my dissertation professor happened to have completed assignments in Colombia and Argentina, and I found a good research project that related to Argentina, because I had not previously visited Latin America. So on my way to Argentina, I stayed 3 months in Colombia, and it just developed the interest.
So it was predominantly that one professor you had at Michigan State that encouraged you to do your dissertation project there?
I think I wanted to do it in South America. He had the connection in Argentina. But had I not had John Hunter as the advisor, and rather had an advisor who dealt with Asia or Africa, maybe I would have ended up there.
Now, you made the comment that when you were down in Argentina working on your project, that's when the war in Vietnam was heating up some. And on the earlier tape, you made a comment that your dissertation professor gave you some advice about staying in Argentina, but we never went into what that advice was. Do you remember what he advised you to do then?
Oh, he advised me to come back to the United States.
And you were thinking at that
time? I think it was a random thought, but I at least raised it in conversation because I was enjoying the lifestyle and the different culture. And not to say I was in love with Argentina, but I liked South America. And not really knowing where things were going in terms of the direction in the U.S., I at least thought, well, that might be interesting to stay down there. And in some sense, my job I was going to take was in Colombia. It wasn't that I was deserting the United States, but I did want to spend more time down there.
Do you think his advice was the right advice for you at the time,
sure.
Looking back now?
Sure.
So you don't regret that?
No.
All right. Now, another point from this period of time was the draft board's advice to you to stay when mm-hmm. you did come back from Argentina and you were trying to get the next job in South America. Your draft board advised you to stay
right.
in the country. We never quite discussed how you felt about that sort of constriction of your options. Can you remember how you felt at the time?
I think that I didn't have real strong feelings at that time in that was an option. I was going to be drafted or have a deferred occupation. Had I not got a deferred occupation, I may have had stronger feelings about that. I wasn't faced with the situation of, do I really want to be drafted or get involved in the war, because I had that option. So it wasn't all that profound at the time, because it was so easy to get a teaching job.
And it wasn't a question that you felt your rights or freedoms were being confined by a policy that you didn't agree with?
No. And the job in Colombia, in retrospect, was a little bit soft. Well, the departing director of the institute basically said it was arranged. I didn't have a formal contract in real detail on what I was going to do. I think it would have worked out, but it was not something that I was lusting for and felt so badly about giving up, because I'd have to go back down and develop what it really meant.
Now, I have to bring in a note. Mm-hmm. A modern day note, okay. A little bit. The skepticism that you had in the beginning was, you know, very real. And I just have to ask, is it still there, or how has it changed? Are you still skeptical about government?
In some ways, and I probably have gone through waves, and I can separate very easily the federal government and state mm-hmm. government. Frankly, the stronger emotion I have right now is a negative feeling about people's cynicism on state government, because I really think there's some better performances and things that are going on that people need to understand. When I see their skepticism about state government, that I think relates some to not understanding the programs or not understanding finance, I have a pretty strong negative reaction to that. I guess I don't like seeing people's skepticism about government when I know more about it, but knowing what I do about the federal government, I still have some skepticism.
But you then were on the one side of people's skepticism, and at one point you were on the skeptical side of
you're right on the skepticism theme, but I think there's a different point there. On the federal end, and I could get into talking about Congress's ability to balance budgets, and the same thing I see on Graham Redmond, for example, is going to handle our budget situation, and they can't stick with it. I see lots more integrity within state government than I do in the federal government, and so it bothers me when people lump that together and are just cynical generally about government.
When you first came into state government, it was during the administration of Tom McCall. And
right.
We mentioned that on the last tape that you were at a level that you didn't interact a great deal with him. But it was also, I mean, you're observant. What was the mood of the state government during the administration of Tom McCall?
It's hard for me to describe the mood, and it would depend a little bit on where in the McCall years you started, because people think of his administration as being creative and capturing the public's attention and imagination. I think that was probably more characteristic of the last few years. It takes a number of years, I think, to get your feet on the ground and get things running. So when I experienced McCall, he was probably in his best years. And it's hard for me, again, to say what is the mood in state government. Everybody liked his personality and liked the excitement. And I did go to a staff meeting or two that he had, and I was involved in the Oregon State study on a tourism component where I got some involvement with the governor. And that was fun. But I really can't say how government employees felt overall.
What was the mood of the state towards him at that time?
I thought it was very positive. From where I sat, people, whether you agreed with him or not, he was on the map, and he had some skilled advisors, and I generally felt like his administration had some control over events and control over our future.
With your benefit now of many years of government service, looking back, is your assessment any different now than it would have been at the time?
I don't think so. I think it's somewhat partial. If there are some points that I would think about, it would be, a governor represents an asset that staffs try to manage in the best sense of the word, try to put him in his best context, give him ideas that he can act on, and I think they did a very good job. I think there's something about quality of staff that stands out for me there. And it was a much simpler world in the government context of the legislative branch. There were the same number of legislators, but many fewer staff, certainly fewer lobbyists. It was easier to get something done in those days, especially if you had someone who would take on an issue and push it. And I had a sense that they did that.
Now, do you feel that there were limitations that he had?
Oh, I'm sure there were. I think there had to be some shoot from the hip aspects that had to be had to be dealt with, and I suspect his staff would have long discussions about why did he do this or why did he say that or why did he make this commitment and go back and try to fix it. That happens, and I suspect with him more than others.
Do you think that people's view towards the state government at that point was much more optimistic than it is now?
Yes.
And was that because of him, or?
I think it has something to do with that. How to separate the times from the person is always difficult. But in any case, I think the times were more positive, and he also was able to capitalize on that. He was a personality that people appreciated and remember.
So your overall assessment towards his effect on the state would be a positive?
It would be positive, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, we began talking about your work in the transportation department at that point. And I was getting involved in the Highway Commission, mm-hmm. and the Department of Transportation. Could you try to just clarify for me how that reorganization of the Transportation Department was taking place at that time?
Okay, it went through various steps, but in 1969 there was a bill passed that created a Department of Transportation, but it was a fairly weak structure. There was a director with a small office, and at the same time they created a public transit division and an aeronautics division, I believe, although there was some heritage of a board of aeronautics. But there was a general feeling that there were these various components of transportation that should be brought together in a department. And as a perhaps a little aside, that's what government was doing then, is pulling together different individual departments with similar interests, like human resources were put into a department about that time. And so they're looking around saying, is there a better way to organize government by consolidating functions or combining functions? So in 1969, there was a step made to do that. But what really happened is that the Highway Division was clearly the largest and most important. And while it was said it was within the Transportation Department, it really didn't function that way. So that lasted for a year or two. I think the next step was really to put George Baldwin in Salem as the administrator of the Highway Division. That they had never had an administrator. It was always a state highway engineer who ran the Department of Highways, and it was a good, strong administrator. So when there, or a highway engineer. So when an administrator was put over the top, it was saying that someone felt that they needed more management than just engineering decisions. And that was a tough job. And George was brought down from the Port of Portland as where he was general manager to do that job. He was very interested in management, was not an engineer, had a more of a financial background and some involvement in politics. So his reaction was to work on a new Department of Transportation. I believe he started his administrator job in 1972. The 1973 legislative session had a bill that Earl Blumenauer, as a young legislator, was very involved in. And that really created a much stronger transportation department. And it did away with the Highway Commission and made a transportation commission, and then brought together public transit, motor vehicles, aeronautics, highways, parks was within highways. And it seems like we're missing one. But anyway, all the functions of transportation under that umbrella.
And so the Highway Commission,
right,
became then a Transportation Commission?
Right.
And did the same people move on to that?
Some. The Highway Commission, as I recall, was a three-person commission, and with Glenn Jackson as chair. And so Glenn Jackson became chair of the Transportation Commission. And on the commission at that time, they took the chair of the Public Transit Commission, the chair of the Aeronautics Board. They brought people together like that, so it was really a matter of each of the different modes of transportation having representation.
And you explained to me last time that governor appoints the commission, and then it was the commission that appointed the director of the Department
that's right.
of Transportation. So
that's what the law says.
Right. Wow. I have an old newspaper clipping that I got about the transportation czar for Oregon. It was from 1970, and it was a man named Fulton, and was he the predecessor of George Baldwin?
No, Fulton was, I think, the first Department of Transportation director when that 1969 department was created. Mm-hmm. I saw very little of Fulton.
He never got to be the transportation czar.
I never saw any particular czar aspect to him. Glenn Jackson was the boss, with highways. Mm-hmm. The Highway Division did not pay a lot of attention to the Director of Transportation in this structure, and didn't have to. So I remember Fulton was the first. It seems to me Sam Haley was the second. And it really was not a powerful position. It was more job owning and looking for policy that would fit. But people who are dealing with policy and don't have many resources don't really get as much done as those who are building highways with resources.
And it said at this point that the highway budget was $225 million, and so they were a big money powerhouse in the state. It makes a comment here in this article that it says, and even its loudest critics of the commission grudgingly admit that Oregon's highway system is probably the finest in the nation.
Hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, that's hard to agree with when you make those statements. Nobody ever compares all those systems. But frankly, my experience nationally with transportation is that we had one of the best systems, and people who would travel from one state to another would comment on the quality of Oregon's highways. So, well, whether or not it was the finest may be debatable, but it certainly was one of the best from at least anecdotal tellings.
It was also, it has to be a smaller system than some states.
Oh, I'm sure it is, but then again, it's larger than some states. If you look geographically, there are about 7,500 miles of highway, and some smaller states, as you move your way east, probably definitely have fewer miles.
Now, as I've looked at the issues that were confronting the transportation department at that time, one of the major problems was the whole question of the energy crisis, the developing energy crisis, and one of the effects that it had on the transportation department was a loss of revenue because of the decline of gas sales. Did you get involved in that issue as an economist?
Oh, quite a bit. Interestingly, one of the things I did, probably asked to do a little bit, but I picked it up as because of an interest, was to do a long paper analyzing the energy situation and its impacts on transportation at that time. And it caused me to get into an overall view of energy, not just petroleum and gasoline. And that may have been a reason why I ultimately ended up as director of the Energy Department. So that was a sort of a related to my job as an economist and a policy person in transportation, but it had that peripheral impact. I got involved generally in revenue. I think they discovered early that it may be an opportunity to have someone with a PhD in economics get involved with the legislature to talk about revenue needs. And that's really how I started in the legislative arena. Even when I was a consultant, I got involved there in testifying along with either with George Baldwin or Fred Clabo, who became highway administrator.
Now, when you're talking about revenue, what aspect of revenue, of the generation or the utilization?
Generation, the two aspects, although it had to cover everything, I really developed an explanation of how the highway system was funded, and then questions of equity between taxing cars and trucks, and then developed revenue proposals based on that. And as recently as yesterday, someone was citing the history, because they're still working on revenue needs in one form or another, and someone cited the history saying what really happened is that Miller testified back in the early 70s about something called cost responsibility between vehicles and convinced people that this was an important principle, and now it leads to some of the highest truck taxes in the nation.
So you're getting blamed for the high truck taxes?
Oh, I think it, maybe. But it was a question of tax philosophy, and it was something that made sense to people.
Do you still have the same view?
Oh, I think that's still a good philosophy. What happens is if trucks pay for the damage they cause on highways, that's the idea of cost responsibility, the taxes tend to be very high because automobiles can drive up and down highways for years and years and not really cause damage because they're built at pretty high strength. But trucks, given their axle configuration, can cause lots of damage. And when you tax them for that, it becomes high taxes. Most states don't do that because politically the truckers have said this will hurt us commercially or hurt us competitively. And I think now in Oregon people are starting to worry about how competitive are we in the trucking arena because of our weight mile tax.
But of course, a contemporary issue with that is the whole idea of the triple trailers. And Oregon has a very lenient law about that.
It does, and I've got some feelings about that. Triple trailers actually cause less damage on highways than some configurations. It really relates to axle loading, not necessarily the number of axles or the number of trailers. And so if there's an argument about triple trailers, it probably relates to safety rather than highway damage. And the safety record for triples, I think, is better than for lots of other truck sizes. The reason it may be safer is because they have been limited on weather conditions and when they can drive. But people don't necessarily like them just visually. There's an emotional reaction. And it was Jane Cease, who was then chair of the Transportation Committee on the Senate side, and I think also on the House side earlier, said if God wanted to have triples, she would have designed a train. So.
Yeah. Now, another issue that we discussed a little bit is the conflict between the allocation of funds between populated areas and less populated areas, and that was another issue that you got into.
That was always an important issue because the highway division would tend to feel that there was a statewide system and lots of people in the organization were brought up with 6 or 8 or 10 jobs in the division. They may work in Roseburg and Medford and Ontario and Bend, and so they get used to the system as they'd work their way up in the career and really had an identification with trying to preserve its quality. So there was that view, but also the population centers would tend to have more people on the highways and say their needs were greater. And if you looked at strictly benefit cost analysis, with more people traveling on the highways, the benefits would be greater, and you would say investment should take place in more urbanized areas. But frankly, for a state like Oregon, you do need ways to get goods from farm to market or for tourists to travel. And so there was a good argument on both sides of that, and one of the things I did was try to balance it, saying there was a need for a statewide system, but obviously there were also needs in urban areas, and it was not an either-or.
Okay. I got a couple other newspaper clippings that show from the early 70s some of the types of of issues that, and that.
Well, say it's the issue that as you'd expect, a Portland area and a Eugene area always thought they should get a higher percentage of the funds.
And here, this was from the Oregonian about the energy problems, throwing the planners off stride. Now, were you?